Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Before we start the show today, I have some exciting news for fans of the show. You may know that I've spent the bulk of my career as a photographer and a director, but you may not know that for every guest that comes on off camera, we go into my studio and we do a photo shoot. And like the show itself, these photographs are intimate reflections of each artist's true personality and, of course, shot in glorious black and white. We've gathered over 200 of these images in a new hardcover photo book called Off Camera the Portraits, and it will be available for shipping before Christmas. It's $55, and I'm going to sign the first 100 copies. So if you go to Off Camera right now and go to the store and click on the book Off Camera the Portraits, you can check out a preview and you can pre-order right now, and a signed copy will be sent to you or one of your loved ones in time for Christmas. If you've enjoyed hearing these conversations with some of the most fascinating creatives of our time, I think you'll love seeing them captured as nowhere before. And best of all, this is a great way to support the show. As you know, you paid nothing for this podcast, but it cost us money to bring the show to you every week. So check out this book, support the show, and enjoy the photography. Now on with the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, painter, musician, singer, catwalker, Rebecca Hall. Rebecca Hall is the star of the new film Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman, which is a fascinating and unconventional origin story. But I wanted to talk to Rebecca because her own origin story is equally fascinating and unconventional. She's the daughter of a renowned opera singer and the founder of England's most famous theater company. She didn't follow either of those paths exactly, but her example taught her the value of believing in what you are meant to do and the joy that comes with doing it on your own terms. Rebecca's terms are pretty simple. Commit with everything you have, or what's the point? Watch her in The Town, Please Give, and especially Christine. You'll be devastated, but you'll see what I mean. In talking to her about her new film and her upbringing, I realized that both had messages I want to pass on to my kids. Messages about acceptance, passion, and hard work. The stuff about threesomes and rope tricks, well, that can wait a little while. Like all the artists I admire most, Rebecca's creative talents, and I'm talking real talents here, aren't confined to one discipline. It's partly why I don't believe her when she says she doesn't own a cabin in the woods, or at least a woodshed. In this episode, she talks about her unconventional life, the toughest role she's ever played on film, why Hollywood takes sex scenes too seriously, and why if you want to be an actor, you might just want to pick up a box of crayons the next time you're in the store. And maybe some cats, too. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
No, my pleasure. Very happy to be here.
It's been really fun for me over the last week, sort of diving into your work. And not only your work, but also into your upbringing and your background and your strange lineage between your mom and your dad and your Instagram account.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on. And I found out through your Instagram account that you're quite a good painter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My little secret. Well, my not-so-secret if I've decided to put it on Instagram.
Let me explain Instagram to you. If you want
to be a secret. Other people see it? Only recently do I understand how to post on Instagram. This has been a large learning curve. Yeah. I just recently had my year anniversary, you know, when they tell you and they tell you what's been, how your year has been. And
that must be at a certain level of followers. I don't get the call from Instagram.
So. No. They send you a thing.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, they send you a thing. They don't send you a thing?
Maybe on your level.
I don't know my level. Like, for what I do for a living, apparently my level is quite...
Well, that's true. So you do have to bump that up a little bit for your level. Gosh, there's a painting there that you did... from Animal.
Right, yes.
Of a character in a wheelchair. It's brilliant. And then there's a sketch that you did of Christine Chubbuck when you did the character that I want to talk about. And there's also strange pictures of you walking your cats around Brooklyn.
Yeah, that does happen. Has been known to happen.
Yeah. Well, again, with the Instagram thing, if you're trying to keep a low profile, maybe pictures
learning
of...
Learning curve.
No, but, you know, it's interesting because I think that...
I think when I delve into your life a little bit, I see like this sort of complete artist life. You're painting, you're playing music, you're walking cats, you know, you're writing, you're and I think that, you know, there's something to that that is doesn't exist in a lot of people who have chosen to become actors. They've focused solely on acting or something. And it seems like you've from the beginning have had this sort of full existence, and not only as a dabbler, as a hobby, but in the case of your paintings, they're really, really good.
Thank you.
And
you,
I think
Thank
you know you. This, too. Like,
I mean,
you know
yeah,
when you're good,
I mean,
right?
I don't... The thing is, I've never really shared it with people. It's a new thing. But it's something that I've always done privately since I was... I mean, when I was really, really little, and both of my parents were, you know... led very busy lives. I didn't have exactly the world's most conventional childhood. It's not, you know, if there was not a babysitter, then it would be a case of the rehearsal room is going to be your babysitting for the day.
Right.
And we should say, in the back and, you know.
Yeah, your father was Sir Peter Hall, who founded the Royal Shakespeare Company. Your mother's this incredible opera singer.
Yeah.
And, yeah, your life was...
Yeah, so I would often be in a rehearsal room, and then how I would sort of keep myself entertained in the rehearsal room from very, very little was I'd always arrive with my sketchbook and my coloured pencils or whatever it was, and I would draw the actors and the people rehearsing.
Wow.
And that was my childhood. And I was really, really quiet when I was little. like really quiet, to the point that I sort of remember my father saying, have you at school made friends?
Really? So you weren't a natural, like, look-at-me person?
No, I was not extroverted at all. I was very keep myself to myself. I wouldn't say I was sort of odd about it or uncomfortable with it. I just quite liked being quiet and watching people. So that whole thing of being able to draw people in rehearsal rooms was kind of, it was quite natural with my personality. It just sort of, it was fun.
Yeah.
So I've always painted. And then when I got a bit older, I, you know, that was the thing that I excelled at school was painting. So, yeah, I know that I can do it. And it's never something that I've stopped doing. It's always something that I've carried on doing. But, you know, I just never thought, oh, I should show the world that I can do this. But it's always been a massive part of my acting process, actually.
Well, I want to talk to you about that, because you said in something I read that you'll often sketch the character when you get a role.
Yeah.
And in the case of a sketch you did of Christine Chubbuck, or of your idea of what that character would be, although she was obviously a real person.
Yeah.
Like, I immediately recognize some of the intentions of her, or the way you ended up playing her. I see it in that sketch, and I wonder if it's chicken and egg thing, if it's like, I'm going to play this person this way, so I'll draw them this way, or if you draw them and then you find out. How does that work?
I think it's that. I don't really know, but I think it's that. I don't know. There's so many. There's a sort of alchemy that goes on with certain aspects of acting and any sort of artistic creative endeavor that's just a little mysterious and weird. So I tend not to delve into it. I know that if I spend enough time thinking about someone's face on an unconscious level, like when you draw, you're concentrating on, you know, where's the, I'm not thinking I'm going to draw them in this expression or I'm going to bring out this aspect of their, I'm not, I'm just sort of, does this line look all right? And does this, you know, does this color work? And does this thing make sense? But something emerges, and you're not really in control of that. And usually what emerges is some sort of understanding of their character, and some sort of, and you get connected in a way because you spend the time thinking about that on an unconscious level. It's not conscious. It's like, well, it's much deeper. And I think that's... So I think I end up learning a lot about how, when I'm done with the drawing, I sort of feel I know much more instinctively how a character will move and speak. And it's not like I've made that connection in my head. It just happens when I try and play them.
It's so funny you say that. No, it totally makes sense, because I think a portrait by definition is one person's interpretation of another.
Right, yeah. It's like, what do you see? What do you instinctively, you know, gather? Also, I love looking at, if I'm playing a real person, I love looking at photographs, because I feel that there's you know, when you meet someone for the first time and you say, hello, nice to meet you, you have this thing that we all talk about, the first impression.
Right.
And actually, the first impressions, you can learn so much about someone in your first impression, but it gets completely colored by everything else within seconds. And then we spend like a process of getting to know someone to go back to some of those first things that you can intuit about someone, I feel. I mean, I really enjoy playing characters. I mean, I feel it's something that I love to do. It's the craft of playing something that's someone that's very different to myself, but ultimately it's all me.
Right.
You know, I don't think at the end of that process, I don't think, wow, I really otherized myself to such an extent. I just think, oh, they were still my choices and there was still my opinion about that person. And I've probably learned more about myself at the end of that process than I have about how different that person is to me.
Is there an example that sticks out in your mind immediately when you told me that about learning about yourself through creating a character?
Yeah, I played a sort of rather extroverted stripper in a Stephen Frears film called Lay the Favorite.
That's right, with Bruce Willis.
With Bruce Willis. And
And you found out you should have been a stripper.
And I found... No, that's surprisingly, it's not what I was going to say, although I just...
That would have made a better story, but yeah. Let's hear the truth.
I suppose I found out that it was all right, that there was a side of my personality that is quite gregarious and is quite fun-loving and it felt as natural to me as anything else. And I think, you know, you go through that sort of like teenage and 20s period where if you get a bit artsy-fartsy, then there's that sense of the cool kid's got to be tortured all the time. And this character, who is a real person, who I spent a lot of time with, called Beth Raymer, she is the antithesis of any of that. And yet she's still a brilliant mind and a kind of brilliant person. And she's just full of like life-loving. That's not quite a sentence, but you know what I mean. She just has so much passion for life. And it sort of, actually playing her was definitely one of those penny drop moments where I was like, it unlocked something in me where I was like, oh, you know what? I really love life as well. And it's okay to be incredibly positive about the world rather than anxious and fraught, because being anxious and fraught all the time is a sort of indulgence that gets a bit boring after a certain age. And that was helpful.
Yeah.
That's one that's helpful.
Well, and I think what you're describing is something that hopefully happens to people on their way to self-awareness, and especially maybe in your 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
When it's like, this persona I invented.
It's like, it's nonsense. Get rid of that.
That's fascinating. You know, in that same thing I was reading about how you sketch the character, you said that you have to be doing several things at once to incubate one thing. And what I took from that was this picture in my head, this romanticized version of being an actor where you're in some cabin and there's a piano over there and there's an easel over there and there's some cats over there with leashes.
So good.
And you're kind of going from one to the other until here's this character. But I did wonder about if the process for you was more instinctual or more felt than analytic.
I think it probably is. I think it's probably both. I mean, you know, people spend a lot of time in interviews talking to me about, oh, you always play smart people and you're very smart and you must approach things very analytically because you went to Cambridge and you read books and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yes, I do rely a lot on this. For sure I do. But I think I rely more on my instincts. No matter how crafted or technical a situation is, I think I get there through gut feeling. And the incubation thing is just about protecting that, you know.
Right.
It's about letting something sit with me, and because I think, you know, when you, I think there is an absolute true way to do something. I think there is only one way that really works.
There's a best approach.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've got to sort of slough off all the stuff that stops you being in tune with that enough to only see what the right thing is. And the thing that there can only be one true outcome.
Like, so what I hear you saying is that if you came in with a rigid process for how to develop a character, you may miss the work you're doing because you don't allow yourself... And
it
hence,
really varies. It really varies. And it has to. And I feel I just have to sort of let things happen in whatever way they happen. And I think the, yeah, it is a bit like that. I don't have a cabin in the woods, but I do have, like, when I'm sort of in this sort of strange process, I get a little dreamy and lost, and there will be some piano music up, and there will be a sort of discarded book, and there will be a sketch half formed, and it's a sort of dotting process between all of them. And it drives my husband crazy because he's like, you know, you've just disappeared into a vacuum for a bit.
God, but it sounds
great.
Like,
you're back.
It sounds great. You know, like, that sounds like a lovely way to work.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really, really arrogant. I get frightened like everybody else. I get frightened that, you know, that, but I'm not tortured by that sort of thing because I don't know. It feels like a sort of an indulgent self-obsession to get too obsessed with that. Like, how I'm not going to do it well enough. It's like, I'll do it how well I do it, and it will be true or it will not be true. And if I just allow myself to just go for it and forget everything else, then, you know, I don't need to obsess about. I don't think about the. I'm not articulating this very well. I just don't think about it in those terms.
Well, you're far too well-adjusted to be this successful as an actor.
I don't know that that's true. I think after the fact, I definitely go down insecure holes.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely, but not when I'm doing the thing. Never when I'm doing the thing. But when the film's, you know, when a film's coming out, I'm like, do people like it? You know, I'm like,
yeah, of course. Well, I just saw Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. And it's this fascinating film about a love triangle between your character, Elizabeth, and another woman named Olive, who was a student of your husband's, played by Luke Evans, and Olive is played by Bella Heathcote. And you invent the lie detector, and you study human behavior like an anthropological psychologist, and you end up in this free love relationship.
Of course.
And then Wonder Woman gets invented.
And I mean, what don't they do?
Yeah, what don't they do?
A little bit of bondage on the way.
A little bit of bondage.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about this film. I would think, as an actor, it's both full of riches of, like, oh my gosh, for someone who loves to build characters and think about what it means to be a human, it's rich. But at the same time, I would think that in terms of plot and characters having things that happen to them that affect what they have to do and stakes, there wasn't a ton of that. It's more like an internal film.
The big conflicts with her was trying to balance these two opposing forces inside of her, which the film is really about in some ways, like
very much
way more so than the origin of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about this sort of, you know, which is the fact that she's the most contrary, she's the most outspoken, she's the most opinionated, fearless person, and she prides herself on that and leads with that. Walks that into a room before anything else, but none of her actions match up with that.
No.
So actually what you have is someone who is riddled with shame and terrified to act out on their truth. And so the journey of the film becomes, how does this woman actually learn to be true to herself? And how do all three of these characters learn to be true to themselves? And then how do any of us actually be true to ourselves despite the odds, which is the real Wonder Woman message in many ways.
I guess the biggest compliment I could give you about the film is that there's a real three-dimensional person there. And it's even, you know, when you see a period film, oftentimes you feel like you're seeing the patina and the patina's done really well, but there was so much focus on the surface that that there's not a human there.
Yeah, I think that's a lot to do with Angela Robinson, who wrote it.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no doubt she wrote the version of this story that was the most personal to her. You know, and she defines herself as, she's a queer lady filmmaker, and she wanted to tell this story that was her, in some way, as much as their story, her story. And she wanted it. She felt that every depiction of unconventional relationships on film, kink on film, all of these things that this film encapsulates, are nearly always told in this slightly salacious, slightly transgressive, slightly seedy way.
Right.
Like there can only be a bad outcome. Like, oh, the husband wants to have an affair. The wife is going to be a victim and be downtrodden and miserable. Oh, they want to have a threesome. Well, that can't possibly. One's going to be jealous of the other and it's going to end terribly.
Right. Or it's played for... There's a second purpose going on of it's sexy.
Right, yeah. Or it's sexy for sexy's sake without any kind
rather than for human's sake of human sexuality.
Exactly. And and so what her intention was, how about we make a film that shows three people working out what they want sexually? Like, let's make that sexy. Let's eroticize that, like the real relations of what's going on and the emotions between these people. And then let's make it like... the most plush, traditional, prestige, beautiful, romantic biopic that that we've seen a million times. So we know exactly where we are when we're watching it, but the behavior that we're seeing is completely untraditional. So the rug is being pulled out from under you, and the hope is that as an audience member, you know, the people, of which I'm sure there are a couple that go into this kind of going, oh, this is going to be a bit titillating and, oh, you know, I'm not sure what I think about this. By the end of it, they're just crying, going, oh, please, I just want them all to be together.
Right.
And they think it's good, and it's normalized, you know?
And
think
that's the subversive element of
this. And that's what's
film.
Subversive about it is that she set out to normalize all of it. And I think she has done an incredible job with it. And part of that is the fact that these women are not stereotyped.
Right.
You know, like it would have been so easy to make a version of this film where Elizabeth Marston is angry and hard done by, and Olive is a manipulated ingenue who doesn't have any autonomy and is lost.
Completely.
And
doe-eyed and...
Instead, what you get is an ingenue who grows into a woman and works out exactly who she is and what she wants, and a powerhouse who chips away at herself to discover that it's okay to be vulnerable to love.
Right.
And that's a big arc for both women. And to have one of those kind of arcs in a film is rare enough. To have like two ladies with an actual huge human arc, I think, grounds it in the world of, okay, this is really about real, this is about people.
There's also a strange coincidence with this film, and you're in sort of a unique position here because this film, there's a love triangle there, and a few years back, you were in Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Yeah, right.
And there's another love triangle, two women in love with the same guy, and the interesting thing about this is one was written by a man and one was written by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sort of in this research project inadvertently to look at all these themes you just spoke about through the male gaze and the female gaze.
I felt the difference. When it came to shooting the sex scenes, there was a different atmosphere in the room, and knowing how it was being shot and knowing what narrative was being told through them, it was different. It was different to other sex scenes that I've been a part of. Often, sex scenes are excruciating because for obvious reasons, but also because from my perspective, because everyone gets really serious suddenly. And, you know, actors get really preoccupied with, like, am I going to look sexy, you know, and I'm going to start doing some push-ups and, like, do some stomach crunches and, like, how can I look the most sexy? And it just, like, every sense of anything real just disappears. It's like everyone stops doing their job for that hour or whatever and then resumes actually acting several hours later.
I imagine that'd be the worst for an actor, to have everyone get really serious.
Yeah,
right?
And it's serious because it's awkward and it's uncomfortable and everyone's nervous and you know and everyone suddenly assumes that if you do sex on screen it has to be very serious, like we have to take it very seriously, and I just find that kind of ridiculous. So I was really I noticed the difference on this because Angela framed a lot of the sex scenes with a different sort of narrative. Like the big one that we do between the three of us, she was like, I don't want this just to be like, you start going at it in a bedroom and, you know, after some whatever it is. She's like, how about we're playing dress up in a theatre,
right?
And there's fantasy and there's game plays, and then that kind of feed into the comic book imagery, and you know, and we'll find these women sort of playing, and I want you to laugh and I want you to have fun. And we did nonetheless all show up to do that scene, you know, sheepish and serious looking and nervous, because you know, that's the mood, and not quite looking each other in the eye. We got ready to do the first take, and Angela called action, and suddenly from loudspeakers we got like the first couple of bars of Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On.
Yeah.
Down. And then we were hysterical. Yeah. Hysterical. There was no going back from that.
That's the secret right there.
And that's the secret right there.
Put on the universal sex anthem. And then everyone...
And then everyone, like, knows where they are. But in all seriousness, I did notice the difference. There was another thing that was different about it, was that Angela was really preoccupied at every step of every interaction, especially the sexy ones, with consent. Like, she was really obsessed with it. And you'll notice, if you know this and you watch the film, everybody asks everybody if they're okay with everything at every step of the way.
Right, so you're not talking about consent among the actors, you're talking about consent among the characters.
In the narrative. But that also, the trickle-down effect of that was that we were all very, like, trusting and careful with each other. And, you know, are you getting enough in the scene? Can I do anything more? And all that kind of thing. But in a really genuine way, there was a real support and trust.
God, it's funny when you say that. I just think... Yeah, that whole idea of, are you okay, you good with this?
Yeah.
Does not go on in those kind of films.
No.
Up till this
point. No, you know, it's like the big, in the, you know, there's a big scene in the movie that's to do with rope play and the Wonder Woman costume. And it's the first time these characters have done anything like this, and they don't, I mean, it's the 1940s at this point. It's just, you know, I have a rope and it looks like it might be fun to tie you up. But in the scene, Elizabeth gets Olive and then she says, are you sure this is what you really, really want? Having initially been like, this is disgusting. Why would anyone want to get tied up? Surely this makes you powerless.
Right.
And then she, explores the whole sort of ethics of BDSM, because she suddenly works out, oh, actually the submissive has all the power. Because they give you permission, and that's how it works in a loving relationship. You ask permission, and then, okay, then we're free to play.
Right.
It's like, but Angela sort of weaves all of this in really subtly in the film. Like, you wouldn't necessarily, so that the audience accepts it. They just accept it all as quite sort of normal. And it's never otherized. It's never like, oh, they're so weird and crazy and kinky. It's just like, okay.
Right, well, early in the film, there's a scene before you have met Olive. Your character has not met Olive yet, and you're sitting on the steps with your husband, played by Luke Evans, and the two of you are observing Olive from across the quad at Radcliffe, and she's sort of fending off the advances from a guy, and you're sort of narrating almost like you're a commentator saying, oh, if she makes too much eye contact, she will give him the sign that she's interested and she doesn't want to do that. And, oh, look at this woman.
Yeah,
this woman doesn't like her because she's prettier. And
she doesn't, he'll think that she's a slut or a bitch or whatever she says, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it struck me that what you were doing there has to be very similar to the job an actor has to do, which is to observe human life and make analytical conclusions about why the behavior is happening.
People watching,
but on a more analytical level.
Yeah, if I wasn't an actor, I'd probably be quite a good therapist.
Really?
I do like to work out things about people. Like, why are you behaving like this? And I wonder why you've made that choice. But I don't think it's like a judgy thing. I'm not like, oh, you're so... I'm just curious about people. And I do find myself doing that a lot.
You have to sort of naturally love doing that to love your job, I would think.
Right. I think you have to love people. I think you have to, like, love human behavior.
Right. To be able to play somebody.
Because you have
somebody.
To just kind of love everything about being a human and everything that's complicated and rich and varied and strange and wonderful about it, but just be fascinated by it.
Yeah. Well, there's another line in the film where Olive says to your character, I think you long for an unconventional life.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm just curious about the atmosphere on the set and if doing a film like this sort of forces you to look at life from a little different perspective.
I don't know. I sort of got that line, you know. I just sort of got it. I mean, I think I personally have had quite an unconventional
life. Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think that, you know, when I think of your life and, again, my cabin in the woods version of it, or the childhood version of you sketching actors and things. I think the difference between like this bohemia type of approach versus a more like grand ambition with a plan for success approach. And in your case, growing up in a home with artists, I wonder if those two things are opposed. And because when I look at a film like this, I go, why can't more of life be like that? Taking
free.
The time to be free thinking and have people around you that really sort of support that. And
radical and unapologetic.
That's right.
Yeah, and
that's
open. Right. And living in that for them and not for... I mean, you know, as the film goes on, obviously, you see these psychologists, who one of which can't be get her doctorate because she's a lady, and the other lose his job because he's not going to sacrifice his family, his family life as he has made it.
Right.
So they both sort of put that ahead of anything else, I suppose, if that's what...
Which we don't really do in real life. It's very hard to find people that can live by their principles when things get really difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
But do you think you grew up in that atmosphere where that was the message?
I think I did, actually. Now you've asked me. Yeah, don't think I've ever really thought about it. But yes, I think I did. I think I did. You know, I think about my mother and her journey from where she was born to what she became. I mean, she was born in Detroit, Michigan, and wasn't, you know, didn't have, you know, the sort of bohemian trappings of education and privilege and all the rest of it. She had none of that. And yet somehow she became involved in the most elite of the arts,
right.
Which opera.
Right.
And there was no reason why she should catapult herself out of Detroit and become an opera star of the magnitude that she did. I mean, it's sort of astonishing. And you look at her and she has real artistic principle and integrity, and she's a perfectionist. I mean, for her, it was art is like, it's just living for that. And so that was my role model, you know.
Right.
And my father, I mean, there's plenty documented about my father, it's kind of just as extreme, really, and at different sides of the globe. But, you know, my father came out of a farming community in Suffolk, essentially, and his father was a station master and catapulted himself into being a Shakespearean and a hugely successful theatre director.
Well, what's fascinating about both your parents is that they didn't come from money or privilege.
No.
And they changed their position in life so far by doing things on their own terms as artists, which is insane.
They changed everything for themselves through doing art. And nobody really gets to do that anymore. Most people who get to do art are like me. They're born into it, or they're privileged enough, or they're wealthy enough to be able to go and do artsy-fartsy things at school, because Lord knows education systems both here and in England now, to an extent, don't really support people to like find these things anymore on their own terms.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think, so heartbreaking, because my parents, you know, they didn't raise me in a sort of privileged, easy sort of way that some people might think. They raised me with that sensibility of what they'd both done, and, you know, the sense of that, how...
Yeah, I'm curious how the lessons got imparted.
Neither of them were ever very... they weren't very rigid.
Yeah.
Like that. They didn't... I don't think they ever really sat down and said, this is what you need to know ever about anything. I think
really?
It was they got on with their lives and I got to watch it, you know, and then they supported me in all my choices, really. They really did, remarkably, actually. And my father always had from when I was tiny, he would always sit down with me and say, what do you think about that? You know, whatever it was that we were talking about, whether it was this play or a cartoon, or like, he'd ask me for my opinion, and it was sometimes really frightening, because you'd have that sense, you know, when your father's, you know, like, am I going to say the right thing? And then quickly I realized that there was no right or wrong thing. He just wanted me to feel free to speak.
That's so fascinating that that sticks out to you from early childhood, that's the way he would choose to communicate with
yeah.
you. And it's such a simple thing, but it's, as parents, you feel so much responsibility to impart things
wisdom.
You think they need.
Right.
You know, the thing of how you get yourself out the door and talk to people before
yeah.
we can get on to, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
But it seems
tying
like...
Tying your shoelaces.
Yeah, but it seems...
I mean, to be fair, my parents probably skipped a little bit of the tying your shoelaces and how to brush your teeth bit, so, you
right.
know.
Right, well, your teeth are lovely. You have lovely teeth. But, yeah, so in your house, there was less focus on the day-to-day. Like when you went to school, did you realize you were sort of different and your home was different than others?
Yeah. Yes, I did. I went to a series of English country schools, which are English private schools in the countryside, which are very specific. It's difficult to explain to Americans. It's like the families that went there were a particular sort of breed. It was very Land Rovers and,
right.
and Parkers and Wellingtons and hunting, shooting and fishing on the weekends.
And Switzerland in the winter.
Yeah, and Switzerland in the winter and all that kind of
yeah.
thing. And really sort of, you know, British class system in full operation. And I was just didn't really, you know, it wasn't like I just didn't fit in that world. It was very peculiar. I didn't really know where to place myself in that English boarding school world. It was strange. A lot of the time it was very strange. I mean, like, to give you one example, my mum's best friend when I was five was a dancer who was in the chorus of a production of Carmen she was doing on tour. His name is Amir Hosseinpour. He's Persian, Iranian, and had lived in, left in the revolution, went to Paris. He's incredibly flamboyant. I think at the time he must have been about 19 years old. So my mother's however old she is at this point. I'm seven. I'm doing a school production of The Little Mermaid in a barn. And I am playing the titular Little Mermaid.
Right.
Quite excited
Ariel,
about it, exactly. And my mum, I know, is coming to watch me with Amir. Amir, by the way, who is now my godfather and one of my closest friends in the world. But they were late. I came out to do the solo or whatever it was, my speech, my big moment. And I'm sort of, you know, because every seven-year-old is like
sure.
doing that and waving at their parents. And I'm like... Oh, and they're not here. It's so upsetting they're not here. Horrid, bring out the small violin, et cetera, et cetera. At which point, the back door barn doors open, and in walks my mother in... also, like, set the scene. This is a sea of green parkas and
right.
and white and blonde and hairdos.
Hunter
and
boots.
Exactly, and... hunter boots and very, you know, very sort of beige-coloured.
Right.
And the doors open and in walks my mother in full black, sunglasses, black hair, red lipstick, and a mirror next to her, who is 6'3", has hair down to here. At the time, I called him Pocahontas, which I'm not even sure is really acceptable, but I did. had hair down to here, and he was in a full-length leather trench coat, like, for all the way to the floor.
God.
Also in sunglasses. They walked in like, they look like they're fucking, excuse me, I think Matrix. I mean, it really was like, it was like the Matrix had just entered the room. And of course, the whole auditorium just like, and spend the whole time looking at them. But yeah, so that, I mean, in that sense, yes. I mean, it was so exotic. My mother is very exotic. I mean, she's beautiful and very, I mean, she's one of the most unusual and extraordinary people you're ever likely to meet, honestly. She really is.
Well, I watched her performance in Salome. And first off, I'm a little uncomfortable. I've seen your mom naked. We're sitting here. And... you know, she looked great. But in Salome, it's like there's a scene where she's got her lover's severed head. And,
yes.
And she's got this outpouring of emotion. The most amazing, honestly, raw emotional performance I've ever seen on stage.
It's breathtaking.
And yeah. it rises in this crescendo, and the notes are getting higher, and then she stands up and she rips her clothes off, and you get the sense that your mom was this, not only this powerful force, but almost like she looks like a human about to explode on stage.
Yeah. That's fairly accurate.
and I can't imagine, because you've described being in the wings during those performances.
Yeah.
You were what,
yeah.
10, 11?
Younger. She started doing that when I was 5. I started watching her do that when I was 5.
So you're like, people go on stage, they lose their shit and they rip their clothes off.
Yeah,
that's
they lose their shit. I mean,
is.
That's sort of normal for me. It's like, unless you go all out, what's the point? I'm like, wait, you're not... Why would you even...
But that's what
I took
away.
Why would you even think about not committing to this, whatever it is? And I suppose that goes back to what I was saying earlier about I believe there is one way to do it.
Right.
You can chicken out and you can do the kind of... You can do the self-conscious, cheaty kind of way of doing something, or you can commit to, like, the one true way of doing that. And that might be horrifying, but you've got to go there. Like, blood, sweat, tears, everything. You've got to go there, because what's the point?
Or why get into this profession?
Yeah,
although, I'm sure you're confronted with this daily, surrounded by a lot of people who get into this profession who have no desire or inclination to go halfway towards that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It must be interesting to have that sort of influence and have that range and try to find opportunities to use that range.
It has been frustrating occasionally.
Yeah.
It has been frustrating when I have done things where I'm like, this, I have nothing to do. I can do this and I can commit to this as much as I can, but there is literally nothing for me to do and I don't know how I'm meant to feel about that. Should I just be happy that I'm working, or should I be kicking and screaming that actually I feel that there's more to my job than this?
Right. And I guess by nature, opera is something where you do. It's a full outpouring of emotion.
And I don't think with acting that everything is about exploding on stage. But
right.
It's like,
but it'd be nice occasionally.
I just mean that there's always a version of that. There's always like a fully, whatever it is, comedy, romance, drama, there's always like a fully committed version of something. And then there's a kind of, where you don't get to do that.
Right. It seems to me, talking to you, that though your parents were in the arts and both were trying to achieve the same things often, they had very different approaches, and that would make for quite a dichotomy in you.
Well, I think I can sort of, I think if I want to trace the way that I'm somewhere right between the overactive brain and a lot of instinctive emotion. The exploding heart. I can trace that right onto both my parents.
Yeah.
I mean, my father was analytic brain. That's what he did. I mean, and emotional. He was deeply emotional and deeply feeling. But how he approached something was like, let's look at the text. Let's look for it how it reveals its truth, and then let's work out how we make that happen on stage. There was a lot of technical and emotional work that went into that. And my mother is, exploding heart.
Right. No, I wonder how when at whatever age you decide to get serious and say, oh, I like this and I'm drawn toward it and everything, how did you not get crushed under the gravity or under the weight of their success and the level of commitment or the level of respect that was bestowed upon them? In other words, how did you make going after this thing your own?
I have no idea.
Oh, come on.
I really don't. I really don't, because it's not easy. And I can't say it's not easy. There are times that I've been tremendously frustrated by the information that walks into a room before I do, and the way people want to pigeonhole me or talk about me or because of what they know about my very successful parents. And then of course there's, but the actual thing of they were so brilliant and so successful, and isn't that intimidating? I cannot answer you why it isn't, but it just isn't. I think it helps that I don't do exactly the same thing that either of them do.
Right, right.
But I took it quite lightly and quite seriously at the same time. I just had, you know, my father always used to say to me, if you really want to act, you have to be, he said that actors, like, they have this tiny little ball of cotton right at their center that's incredibly vulnerable and makes a great actor a great actor, is this sensitivity. But the ones who survive and actually do it are the ones that are able to somehow encapsulate it in several layers of steel and iron. And that steel and iron is strong because you never for a second doubt that it's what you're meant to do. Like, you just know it's what you're meant to do. And he'd say to me, if you feel that you have that, then you're golden. And when he said that to me, I was never like, I was just like, oh no, yeah, okay.
He was describing you.
I was like, I get that. And I do feel that. I don't feel that there's anything else I'm meant to be doing. Apart from all the things that I love doing, well, the painting and the music and everything.
Well, sure, and that's the
but
other
like,
question.
Basically, I didn't doubt it, and I never felt like, and I wasn't, this sounds disingenuous, but I wasn't preoccupied with becoming a star. I wasn't preoccupied with doing really, really, really well at it. I was just preoccupied with being able to do it. You know, that was like, if I can just do it. Great.
Boy, as I listen to you talk, I think they did such a great job with
yeah,
you. Because
they did.
Like, it seems like you do it for the right reasons and you're supposed to be doing it. Although, I will say, looking at your painting and looking at, you know, watching you play the piano in Tumble Down, I think that there could have been easily some consideration of doing other things. And
yeah.
I sometimes wonder about that with people who are talented in other places. If you get sort of melancholy about the fact that we do only get one life. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do sometimes. You're not wrong. I do. You know, I'm thank my lucky stars for my successes as an actress. But sometimes I'm slightly sort of like, well, if I hadn't been so successful, maybe I would... Maybe I would have had to force myself to like write and direct a film already, or like, you know, do a, you know, go and sing in a band or whatever it is. These
right.
other like little secret things that I'd love to do. And, you know, there's still time though. I'm kind of, you know, I feel like it's just the beginning.
But I think that is one of those sort of odd little secrets about great success, is that you have to sort of serve it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Although I do feel like the choices that
you
make...
And also, in this line of work, you never know when it's going to stop. It's like, it's that, never very safe, because the moment you have success, you're like, well, I've got it, now it's going to be over tomorrow.
Right, but I think that's the thing. I think if you continue to have sex...
That was the best Freudian
yes.
tit ever. But if I do,
yeah.
I mean, I hope I do.
I mean, look,
but,
you should.
You
it's healthy. You're married, so clearly that's part of a
I mean,
healthy
it's
relationship.
It's hopeful that one will continue.
If you continue to have success, like I predict you will, and sex, I think that you could look up 20 years from now and go, wow, I just have had to serve this the whole time. And I wonder about that idea of living an artist's life, and how do you keep yourself full and keep filling, because you can lose. You can
yeah.
lose painting if you don't paint for 10 years.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I did lose painting for a bit because I couldn't travel anywhere with paints, and then suddenly I discovered the whole iPad app thing, which suddenly changed my life. And I was like, oh, I have paints that I can travel everywhere with.
Do you know where I discovered that? I saw a Hockney thing in Bilbao, and
yeah.
he had done it all on the iPad.
Yeah. They're extraordinary, yeah. Some
yeah.
of them are great.
And I
and
think
the
that was on an
even,
early version. Yeah, exactly.
The technology's even better. Like the app that I have is insane. You can customize these brushes, and it does exactly like, you know, like if you go harder, it goes harder. It's amazing, really amazing.
Gosh, but it is an interesting conundrum
but yeah,
to be
no,
successful.
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. I think it takes an enormous act of courage and will to to decide to steer the ship in a different course because you're not satisfied if you're successful.
Right.
And
right.
I hope that if that ever, I mean, acting, I love it right now. And right now I seem to be going through a patch of getting roles that I'm really happy about, you know, that are really exciting for me. And I just hope that if that shifts and it doesn't go that way, then I'll be able to steer the ship and be like, okay, now I'm going to go do this.
Or double down and work harder because you're like, where did my career go? yeah. Well, okay, so I want to talk to you about Christine a little bit because this film is such a powerhouse, amazing film. And I would assume there's some heartbreak. And tell me if I'm wrong, but now that you've had some distance from it, that's probably the most amazing work I've ever seen you do.
And thank you.
For people who don't know, Christine is a film where you play Christine Chubbuck, a real-life woman who was a local newscaster on a Sarasota, Florida TV station, and she killed herself on live television and became sort of the one-sentence exploitative idea of American violence and media.
Mm-hmm.
And had her life reduced.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Right, the ultimate... Yeah. If it bleeds, it leads. And had her life, her entire life reduced to one sentence. And what you managed to do with this film was give her the humanity to sort of shed light on whatever bipolar or whatever maladies that drove her, but also shed light on the fact that she had dreams and hopes and she was optimistic, she was smart. And
funny, and she was a person.
Right.
Complicated one.
Right.
Person.
But I also understand from the perspective of, you know, we know how this film ends and we're not going to walk out of the theater feeling good, that it was a hard thing from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the question is, for me, when you're an actor and you put your heart and soul into a project like that and it doesn't get seen as widely as it should and it doesn't get seen the way it should based on the reviews and based on doing everything right about making a piece of art...
Mm-hmm.
How hard that is to just move on from, because it's an experience every actor has. Every actor has had an experience where they worked really hard and then it didn't receive the...
You know, you spoke a little while ago about that sort of tension between having a perspective on this business that's sort of bohemian and unambitious and then the very ambitious.
Right.
I think I realized during the course of that film coming out... I think it was the first time in my career that I looked at a piece of my own work and said, oh, I did it. I did the thing I wanted to do. And I'm really, really proud of it. And I'm ambitious for this film. Like, I want people to see it. I think it's important. And not just because I want to sort of flout around and say how wonderful I am. I'm just really proud of it on like a really basic level.
Sure.
I want people to see it. And I threw everything into it. You know, I'd never done that. I joined social media.
For that film, to get the work.
Because I was like, I'll do anything I can at this
point. Listen, where I come from, like, that's a major price to pay. That's like a pound of flesh.
It was a bit of a pound of flesh.
Yeah.
And I've kept giving it, apparently. Now I can't leave the bloody thing.
No, you can't.
No, because once you join the modern
you're
age,
on there with your
you're stuck.
In Brooklyn.
That's it. It's over. I can't go back. Oh, dear. But, so I'm not going to lie. It was really painful. I mean, it's less painful a kind of a year on, because every day, and I'm not joking, every day I'll get an email in my inbox or a something on my Twitter or whatever it is, either from regular people who have just stumbled across it because it recently came out on Netflix, so suddenly all these people have stumbled across it, sort of saying, you know, often saying, I suffer from mental health issues and I'm so grateful to you for doing this and thank you and I'm so moved by your performance. But then also, like, from an industry perspective, I'll get, like, you know, I got an email from Charlie Kaufman dropped into my inbox saying this performance was the most extraordinary and, you know, these are the reasons why and, you know, and that, it's really gratifying to remember that, you know, the films aren't just around for the week that they are in cinemas. If you're lucky, an independent film stays in the cinema for a week. Or the awards season or whatever it is. They are, like, we do this because actually they stick around for life. And so that one, I'm like, I'm kind of over my pain. I had a real, like, painful moment, and then I thought, get over yourself. Like, this film is going to be there. People will get to it eventually.
Right.
And they are. They are now. And it's weird to sort of have that thing of people are discovering it slowly. But I'm gratified that they are. So, you know, I'll never stop being proud of that. I do think it was the hardest... It was the hardest role that I've ever had to do on film, and it was the most, I don't know, it gave me a lot, you know? I felt a huge responsibility to her and to all and stories of women, difficult women with mental health issues who were unappealing that people would rather not see as movie fodder.
Or forget mental health for a minute. Just women who are ambitious and they find the glass ceiling or whatever it is. I feel like mental
it
issues
covers
aside,
all of that. Mental issues aside, it covers all of that. And I will be proud of that film forever. But yeah, you put your heart and soul into stuff. You do. It's unfortunate that it then gets like, oh, move on. But that's the way it is. That's what we do. You know, you can't bemoan that too much. It is. Making entertainment, we're not saving people. Maybe we are a bit.
Maybe a bit with that film, actually.
I had a couple people write things that didn't sound far off that.
No, people should see that film. But I guess it begs the question of where does the joy come from, really? I mean, really, is it in the process for you?
Like,
maybe there's an example of finding a key to that character during your process or during something that sort of illustrates the joy of what you do. And because what you describe when you describe that film, it sounds like love to me.
Yeah, you're not wrong. That's kind of an accurate. You do the whole process of making a film and playing a character and making the story, committing to telling that story, it is like falling in love. You go there, it becomes your life for that patch of time. It's everything.
Yeah.
But it's always fun, you know. For me, I think that it really has to be fun.
Yeah.
And I mean that even with the Christines, like even the darkest, you can't go into it being like, because when you're in the moment and it's working and you're in that flow or whatever you want to call it, when it's everything is right and you know you're on that path that's making sense and it's working, there's a joy that an exhilaration that comes with that of just being able to do the thing that you can do and doing it with a group of people supporting it and everyone's enjoying the fruits of doing it, you know, and that has got to be there. I think the moment that you start whatever it is, drama, comedy, whatever it is, the moment that you start, someone calls action and you're like, oh God, I can't, I need to, it's dead. It's got to be, you've got to find that place where you love it. You love it and you just want to do it and you're exhilarated by it, because that's when it stops being about you and becomes about the story.
Yeah. Well, I've been a fan. I think I first saw you in The Town, so not since the beginning, but I really enjoy your work. And I was sad to hear that you lost your father a month ago. And,
thank you.
And I did wonder about that. I don't know what that feels like. Both my parents, thank God, are still around. And but I wonder how you remember him, how he comes up, especially being sort of like, you know, in that position where you were in the same business and this and that, how he comes up to you. Does it sneak up or does it come in lessons or does it come in work? Or
he seems to be cropping up in all sorts of ways at the moment. I suppose there's sort of waves of things right now because it's still pretty fresh. But, you know, he was not really entirely with us as I fully remember him for some time because he was... Towards the end, for the last 6 years, he was suffering from a dementia, Alzheimer's situation. And, you know, so during that time, I found myself sort of wanting to remember all the things about him that I could and loved and cherished. And it was hard because he was still there, and so I was remembering that. And in the last month, it's really, a lot has come flooding back from, like, my childhood, from my 20s, from when I worked with him. And I just, you know, I remember his passion and his will and his just unshakable support for his children. I mean, he had such pride in all of us. He had 6 children, and we've all done all sorts of things. And it didn't matter what we were doing. He was just sort of daily enchanted by us all. And I, you know, and he gave me such faith in myself.
Yeah.
That's a real gift. And I'll thank him forever for that.
Well, both your parents did something right, because the way you approach your work and the kind of work you're doing and the roles you're choosing, your paintings on Instagram, everything. It's just great work. And I've loved getting to know you a little bit.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being so honest and you know, yeah, letting me inside the process a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show for today, and I hope you were as inspired as I was to hear Rebecca talk and hear a little bit more about her life. She's really an incredible one-of-a-kind artist, and if you haven't checked out her Instagram page yet, do so. You'll love her artwork and her take on the world. And go see Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. And once you've done that, go back and watch Vicky Cristina Barcelona, The Town, Please Give, Christine, and all of her other work. She's a restless artist making great work, and she deserves a long look. And when you're done doing that, take a long look at offcamera.com. Like I said at the beginning of the show, this podcast is free to you, but it costs a lot for us to bring it to you each week. And one of the ways that we can keep bringing it is with your continued support of the show. We don't ask for much, but if you can go to the store and support us by buying a magazine or getting a digital subscription to be able to watch every episode of the show, or in our newest way and just in time for Christmas, by getting our brand new hardcover photo book, Off Camera, The Portraits. It's available for pre-order right now. You can get a signed edition and it'll arrive by Christmas. So check that out and support the show. I want to thank everyone that helps me on the show. Nathan Shields, Crawford Shippey, Kara Johnson, Laura Kemper, Michaela Galvin, Amy Jones, and a special congratulations to Matt Davidson, who received his extermination and fumigation license this week. Way to go, Matt. Couldn't do it without you, buddy. And most of all, thank you for tuning in, for listening, and for your letters, your social media posts, and for everything you do to spread the word about this show. Speaking of which, if you want to spread the word about the show, we are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can also reach me via email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. So drop me a line. Don't be shy. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress, singer, director, and producer Emmy Rossum.
For me, I'll always be hardest on myself about music and voice, because the first teacher that I had was so hard on us. And if it wasn't perfect, then it wasn't worth even doing it, which is a kind of at odds with the idea of art
and singing and
an organism
expression.
And expression, because it's the imperfections that make it feel human. And yeah, I'm never going to win in that arena with myself.
She wasn't the first choice to play Christine in Phantom of the Opera, and no one thought she could play Fiona Gallagher on Showtime's surprise hit Shameless. Both roles changed her life in unexpected ways. How she escaped a career of princess roles and became the head of the most degenerate, bankrupt, and strangely optimistic family on American TV is a story you won't want to miss. It's inspiring, funny, and chock full of Legos. See you next time, off camera.